Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we have another great soapbox for you, and my guest today is Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu will tell us a little bit about himself, but he is an author, an analyst, and an activist. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu Baraka, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you, Cindy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. Do I hear birds tweeting in the background?
Well, you might, and you might hear some dogs barking and some roosters and all the sounds of Colombia.
Life. That's called life, huh?
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. I used to have grandkids bursting in on my interviews, dogs, just like dogs barking, everything else right. Going on. So, before we get into the substance of the interview, tell my listeners a little bit about yourself.
Well, I mean, I guess I would characterize myself as a long-term activist, a human rights activist. I've been involved in social change work for all of my adult life. Based in the southern part of the U.S., as a southern organizer, ended up organizing one of the first and only human rights network in the country that is primarily committed to applying human rights to the U.S. That is the U.S. Human Rights Network. I left that operation in 2011 and been writing. Right with the for the Black Agenda Report, Counterpunch, at a number of different outlets, progressive outlets in the U.S. And currently, I live in Colombia, where I'm working with progressive and Black organizations, supporting some of the work that's taking place in Colombia and in the Americas.
Well, great, thank you so much for that. I, of course, came through your work through the Black Agenda Report and our connection on the Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I just think, besides the limitations of Facebook, I think it's been really great for connecting people and like-minded people from around the world. So I'm just really glad that we're connected that way.
Yes, yes, I am too.
So, wow, there's just so much happening on the planet today. It's just, it's overwhelming, I think. And we obviously can't, this is a half-hour show that happens once a week, so obviously can't cover everything. But there's been two significant pieces you've published on Black Agenda Report. Recently, and I know the Black Agenda Report is something that we on the true left have really appreciated, especially during the Obama years, when we felt, at least I felt, I can't speak for the entire true left, but I felt kind of lost out in the wilderness, and always appreciate the analysis on the Black Agenda Report.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very important because, as you said, I think for a couple of years, the left was sort of in paralysis in terms of seeing the contradictions of this Obama administration. But at the same time understanding the significant support that it had with the Black community and not wanting to appear to be overly critical, you know, the critique coming from the Black Agenda Report and from other sources like folks around Counterpunch, I think that helped to kind of give people the freedom and the courage to really begin to be as critical as we needed to be with this neoliberal Black president.
Oh, absolutely. So, Syria, the subject of Syria is really something that is left out of many, you know, reports, news reports, analysis, and things like that. But you just wrote a piece called The Obama Two-Step in Syria. And one thing I just really pulled out of that that great analysis is when you said Obama is now taking a familiar position that European imperialists have taken for years after committing unspeakable crimes against humanity. They feign innocence. Can you give us the background and your thinking on that statement?
Well, you know, Cindy, that's, you know, one of the things we've seen over the last few hundred years, in particular within the context of European humanist thinking, is that there's been an inability for European liberalism to really come to terms with many of the crimes that have been committed over the last few hundred years, with the conquering, for example, of the West, I mean, of the Americas, slavery, the colonial expansion, the world wars. I mean, you know, when these things occur, there's not a serious sort of critical analysis, lessons learned, and a real attempt to break with that history and try to construct something new. Instead, you know, these incidents are explained away. When people are identified as being responsible for these horrendous crimes, they will have these elaborate explanations as to, you know, why they were involved and how they were misled. So Colin Powell would talk about the fact that he was misled by the intelligence community when he came before the United Nations. You know, all of the supporters of the invasion of Iraq will pretend that they didn't know that they were cooking the intelligence and that they had another agenda. You know, it is a familiar retreat, a moral sort of retreat that many of these criminals tend to engage in. So what we see with Obama, we know that it was his administration, his policies that moved toward creating the civil war inside that country. We know that they were heavily involved in working with their allies in the region to fund, train, and equip those forces that ended up being primarily jihadist forces. And so we know that to be a fact. But now Barack Obama, because it's clear that his policies have been unraveling and that Syria is in fact a mess, that they have not been able to achieve any of their foreign policy goals in that country. Now he's pretending that, you know, he was forced into this. I refer to this as, you know, the devil made me do it defense. But, you know, history is an interesting phenomenon. And, you know, when we look at what happened in Syria, we look at his policies. Unfortunately for Barack Obama and his supporters, he is right in the middle of this criminal action.
Right. And what you gave a couple of their so-called foreign policy goals in the article. It reminds me so much of the shifting justifications for Iraq under the Bush regime.
Exactly, exactly. And with consequences as devastating for the people in Syria. The major difference, though, between those two experiences is that along with the suffering and destruction that we saw in Iraq, we also had the suffering and destruction of loss of life, unfortunately, for many of us among people who were from the U.S. The young soldiers who ended up going to that country thinking that they were, in fact, defending freedom and defending the nation, who came, some didn't come back, and many came back with, you know, maimed for life. So with the same kinds of justifications, the same kinds of escaping of moral responsibility that we saw in Iraq, we see the same things happening in Syria. But again, the difference is that this time the U.S. is involved in a war of aggression, but indirectly. You know, they have assured the American people that this time there will be no U.S. boots on the ground. Instead, what they decided to do, and this decision was made toward the latter part of the Bush administration, and Seymour Hersh exposed this, and I talk about this in my piece. Yes. The Bush administration decided they're going to reenact the Mujahideen strategy of Afghanistan in the 1980s, right, and that the boots on the ground were in fact going to be those right-wing jihadist forces.
Right. So I think that is really significant because it was a policy, like you point out, that the Obama regime chose to continue, but now, like you say, are backing away from it.
Exactly. And it's unfortunate that, you know, concentrated power can in fact do this. But the results of this disastrous policy, we see within Syria with the massive displacement, and we see, you know, refugees that are streaming into Europe. We see the consequence of these policies. And so they can pretend to be innocent. They can back away and shift their focus someplace else. But what happens is you leave the wreckage of those policies, and it's really inhumane. And what's also inhumane and unprincipled is the relative silence of people in the U.S., in the West, on the left, who should know better, who have not really been as forceful as they should be in trying not only hold these public officials accountable, to be in active resistance to these wars of aggression, to the permanent militarization of U.S. policy. And it's really been an incredible spectacle to see how the anti-war and peace movement, how silent so many of those forces have been. There have been some consistent ones, no question about that. But, you know, you refer to the true left. I mean, that the true left that's been clear about these positions, unfortunately, we are in such small numbers. And right, how people are able to explain to themselves and justify to themselves their objective alignment with these policies is really incredible.
Well, in fact, I think a couple of years back, a little fuzzy about the timeline, there was talk from the administration about boots on the ground in Syria, and there was a mild, there was mild opposition to it in the anti-war movement. I use that term loosely, but really, I think that it was mostly Vladimir Putin in Russia and international community that had an effect on that. And then after that, significantly, is when the U.S. backed the neo-Nazi coup in Kiev.
Yes. But, you know, Cindy, what is so interesting about that, and you're absolutely right, but what is interesting about that in terms of the difference in the solidarity movement in the U.S. is that the only time that you did have a bit of an increase in opposition was when there was the prospect of direct U.S. involvement in Syria. Mm-hmm. That, to me, it is reflective of a strange kind of narrow selfishness that it's you know, if we understand the role that this country plays in creating these kinds of situations where people lose their lives and their societies are destroyed, that the criteria cannot be that we're only going to be upset when our people are directly involved. You know, where is the common connection to humanity? So, yeah, you're right. I mean, they shifted from Syria, and they increased the subversion in Ukraine. And many people don't understand. And my analysis of what happened in Ukraine was that this was, in fact, a second front. That the primary objective of U.S. policy was to undermine Assad, to bring about regime change in Syria. And because of the obstructionist role from the point of view of the U.S. administration that the Russians were playing, they intensified the efforts in the Ukraine. And so this was a way to divert Russian focus and resources and time. But the genesis of this, in my opinion, was Syria. Even though they had an ongoing objective in Ukraine, it became a sort of a win-win for U.S. policy. You can force them to shift their focus away from Syria back to Ukraine, while at the same time you can continue your objective, which is basically to expand the EU and NATO influence up to the borders of the Russian Federation.
Oh, absolutely. And what we were just talking about brings us to our next subject. The reason I contact you to have this interview is because you of your piece called "Why Is Cornel West Sheepdogging for the Democrats Once Again?" And I think through this article, criticizing Cornel West or analyzing his support for Bernie Sanders, you also criticize Bernie Sanders and why Cornel West should be more analytical in his support and actually enthusiastic, unwavering, as Cornel is. You know, he doesn't ever do anything halfway. You know, not just as Bernie Sanders okay on some things. He's a prophetic. You know, he's a savior. And see, I really don't think he has very much political credibility because he did the same thing for Barack Obama. But my point is, what we were saying is, I just spoke in upstate New York, and it was a peace rally, and so it was near Woodstock, so there were a lot of older white liberals there. And I was severely attacked. I don't want to say I was like physically attacked, but verbally attacked by these people because I do not support Bernie Sanders. And so I kept on bringing up to them, but what about his foreign policy? Do you want to trade campaign promises that may or may not come to fruition if Bernie Sanders probably wouldn't come to fruition? If Bernie Sanders became president, do you want to trade those for the people of Palestine, for the people of Syria, for the people of Iran and Ukraine? Do you want to trade? Do you want to trade those things for just like campaign promises? Do you want to throw all those people under the bus? And it's like they don't even give a crap.
You know, Cindy, it is so unfortunate. I mean, and because I think you're right. I mean, I raised the question in my piece. What about the people in the world? Why is it that it is acceptable for leftists in the U.S. to, in essence, make an argument that the people in Gaza, in Syria, the people who are going to be impacted by Bernie Sanders' position that the Saudis should be given more of an opportunity to redo the Middle East, if you will. Why should those people's interests be sacrificed for what you perceive to be the greater good of getting Bernie Sanders elected? Because He may have some more quote-unquote progressive ideals in terms of domestic policy. It is unprincipled and is a reflection of not only the organizational weakness of the left, but the ethical weakness and confusion among left forces in the U.S. And unfortunately, Cindy, it has something to do also too with this ability for white leftists to, while they can give lip service sometimes to this issue of this slogan of Black Lives Matter and all of that, it really appears that other people's lives really aren't that valuable when it comes to the interests and objectives of the European left in the U.S. and in Western Europe, that those people can be sacrificed for the greater quote unquote the greater good. It's really strange and unfortunate. And I know you got some pushback because when you raised that, those kinds of questions, you know, it really makes people angry because I think they know the moral contradiction.
Well, to me, and it's just like we have to fight this battle over and over and over again. We can't be critical of the faux-gressive icons, I call them. But, you know, they call me narrow-minded because I'm focusing on the global aspect of this, where I'm narrow-minded because I don't support Bernie Sanders because I focus globally, where Bernie Sanders doesn't have one thing about foreign policy on his, you know, campaign website.
No, and it's a contradiction that they will accuse you of being narrow-mindedness because you were thinking about the globe.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy.
I know.
And even with Bernie Sanders, for example, even his opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, even that, the way it's framed, is primarily framed as an issue of U.S. economic nationalism, and that one in which the solidarity with the people who are going to be super exploited as a consequence of this agreement, that the impact it's going to have on them. Again, it comes back to how this is going to impact on people in the U.S. I mean, that's narrow. You know, that's a very narrow and unfortunate position.
That's the definition of narrow. So let's talk about the term sheepdogging. I think it was coined by another writer, editor of Black Agenda Report, Bruce A. Dixon. Can you talk about that term?
Well, you know, Bruce first raised the issue of objectively, what is the campaign, what is the Bernie Sanders campaign doing related to the Democratic Party? Especially when it was clear from the very beginning that Bernie Sanders said he was going to support whoever the nominee was of the party. And at that point, it appeared there's going to be Hillary Clinton. So Bruce said that, in effect, what Bernie Sanders was doing was, in fact, sheepdogging, gathering support, keeping people in line, expanding the base of the Democratic Party for Hillary Clinton. And so I use that same term and said that if Bernie Sanders is, in fact, sheepdogging, then Cornel West's enthusiastic support for Bernie Sanders makes him a sheepdogger also. And the issue is this, Cindy, the way I see it. The reason why that isn't, I think, an effective sort of metaphor to use is because I think people forget that, for example, in some of the Democratic primaries, some of the Democratic primaries are closed primaries, meaning that if you are not willing to register as a Democrat, you can't participate in the vote.
Right.
So you have to, it's a mechanism that objectively expands the Democratic Party base. And they know that those people who may decide to register in order to participate to support Bernie Sanders, that if Bernie Sanders does not win the nomination, they're probably still going to participate. Some of them may not, but they many of them will. So, you know, it's objectively expanding the Democratic Party. Now, look, my issue with this is this. I'm not necessarily even opposed to an internal move within the Democratic Party to try to consolidate and build an oppositional base. If that was, in fact, the strategy.
Right.
If this wasn't a candidate-centered, activity in which, you know, once Bernie Sanders loses, or even if he won, that there's no institutional base in order to hold him accountable and to really push politics within the Democratic Party to the left. That's not going to happen. So people are being sold a false bill of goods that mm-hmm. supporting Bernie Sanders in this campaign is going to have any real impact on the rightist motion of U.S. politics. It's not going to happen. We're not building independent institutional bases on the left. That basically we are objectively strengthening hegemony in this country, ideological hegemony, and strengthening the institutions of hegemonic domination, in this case, the Democratic Party. And I can't be for that.
Well, it's the same BS that Obama supporters told us back in 2008. We have to make him, he said, you know, like Roosevelt did, make me do it. We have to hold his feet to the fire. as soon as I started doing that, I was like, give him time. Then it came to, you got to give him a chance.
Give him some time. Yeah.
So it's just like, we can't win except through revolution. Speaking of that, this is a lit, thank you so much for that analysis, Ajamu. But this is like way out of left field. I'm speaking with you on Skype, and I see your picture. Your Skype picture says "Cure Racism, Shoot Back," and you know, I recently watched a documentary called "Negroes with Guns."
Yes.
The life of Robert Williams. I just want to highly recommend that to my listeners. And do you have a comment on that?
Well, my comment is that basically the right to self-determination and self-defense is in fact a right. I'm not advocating that we engage in sort of unorganized and wild, random
right.
Violence, but that people like Robert Williams understood that we could not engage in an effective democratic struggle unless we also had the means to be able to protect ourselves. So right now, the main objective is political organization, but we also have to recognize that as this country is moving toward and what I believe to be a neo-fascist phase, political organizations also are going to have the ability to be able to protect their members and their communities. Hopefully we don't have to engage we don't have to take that far, but you know, that is something that we have to be aware of and be prepared to, in fact, support if need be.
Well, and it was occurred like in the late 50s, early 60s, the struggle, I forget the name of the town in North Carolina.
Monroe.
And
yeah.
It dramatically, if not totally, eliminated violence against black people in that town during a time when lynchings and bombings and other KKK terror was prevalent.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, and again, you know, we've seen the historical examples of when it was clear that communities were able to and prepared to defend themselves, and in fact had the consequence of dissipating violence. We got to remember that, for example, even with the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in Oakland,
right?
You know, before they passed that piece of legislation that, in effect, meant that the party could no longer openly carry weapons, that's when the slaughter started.
Right.
There was no murders of Black Panther Party militants before that, when they were armed, using under the Constitution and the laws of California, the confrontations did not take place. It was after they were in effect disarmed that you had the beginning of the physical assaults on that party in California and really across the country.
Well, right, and like I said, please, if my listeners haven't already done so, check that. He wrote a book. Robert Williams wrote a book called "Negroes with Guns," and then there's the documentary that I thought was really inspirational. And the thing is as informed as I am, majored in U.S. history, etc. That's the first time I ever heard of Robert Williams, but I sure have heard of Martin Luther King Jr.
Exactly. And there's no accident for that. Even though there was some very militant aspects of Dr. King, yes. But the Dr. King that became popular was the Dr. King of I Have a Dream in 1963, as opposed to Dr. King of April 4th, 1967.
Exactly.
That called for the withdrawal from the U.S. in Vietnam and the Poor People's Campaign.
And that's one that we're not really allowed to learn about here in the United States. Well, Ajay Mubaraka, I can't believe our time is already up. And I'm going to link your articles on my newsletter and on my webpage for this show. But for people who come through it, come to the show, not through those tools, can you tell people where they can look?
Yes, I have and nowadays we all have to have these things. So I have a site, ajamubaraka.com, and there's a whole list of my writings there. In particular, going back to Syria, I wrote stuff a few years ago on this Syria situation that maybe people might be interested in. So yeah, ajamubaraka.com.
Okay, great. Ajamu, have a great weekend, and thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
And thank you, Cindy, and thank you for all the work that you do.
Perfect. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's the Soapbox for this week. I hope you were informed and inspired for further action or study. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, and I'd like to thank Ajamu Baraka for being our guest today. I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. And please go to CindySheehanSoapbox.com if you enjoyed this. Spread the word, send the links around, or donate to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox to keep us on the air. We're approaching our 200th show. I think we probably have that by the end of this year, and I think that really is, in my opinion, something to celebrate. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.